Hey everybody, welcome to the podcast. This week my guest is comedian Brian Scott McFadden, but before we get to that, I'm going to be performing at the Improv Comedy Club in Fort Lauderdale at the Hard Rock Seminole Casino this week, this Thursday through Saturday, July 16th to the 18th. Come check out a show, always a great time, and it's Florida in the summer. Who can beat that? Woo! Yeah. Now it's a great club, great venue, July 16th to the 18th, this Thursday through Saturday, five shows, the Improv. Come check it out. Always have a great time there, great fans there. And this week, my guest, comedian Brian Scott McFadden, very funny guy, good friend. He's been on The Late Show with David Letterman, The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, and one of the biggest voiceover guys in the country. He's the voice of the Serta sheep in the Serta commercials. He's been in Ice Age 2. You hear him, you're going to recognize his voice. Enjoy the podcast. Come see me this week at the Improv in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. I am on with my friend. Do I call you my friend? I guess, right? Are we friends?
Yeah. Well, it depends on how honest you want to be. Like, if you're going to con people, then then go ahead, do whatever you do. How honest is this podcast? Is this one of these heartfelt, psychological, kind of insightful look with underneath the hood of? Of various and sundry artists who come on this thing?
All right, that is
because yes, we're friends,
that,
Paul. To answer your question, yes.
That is the wise-ass voice of my friend, comedian extraordinaire Brian McFadden, whom
Acquaintance? Moderate a person I know within the confines? Peer?
Peer,
I don't know, what else?
Someone I borrow money from occasionally? Maybe that.
Yes, yes. Someone who's lent you cab fare and bailed you out of numerous sticky situations, which will remain nameless.
You know,
posting bail bondsmen, stuff like that.
Let me tell people that you appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman, which is a show I understand got canceled due to poor ratings.
The show was canceled?
The Letterman show was canceled due to poor ratings. That's my understanding.
Not my episode. It was one of the highest rated episodes they ever had on the show. It was like unbelievably highly rated. More than the moon landing. More people saw my, the moon landing and I think Super Bowl six and the last Tony Awards. I think I was highly rated more than that.
And you also what
else do you want to know? I'm a big draw. This show, this podcast is going to send your this show rocketing through the stratosphere. Didn't you have like somebody big on recently?
I've had Paul McCartney, Jay Leno.
I know. How the hell did you pull that off?
See,
How did you manage to finagle a Beatle onto your show? And this is, you know what I mean?
Here's why people hate people in show business and comedians. When I tell somebody who is not part of the entertainment world that I got Paul McCartney, the response universally is, wow,
it's awesome.
That's
oh my God,
right.
What an honor.
And when I tell anybody in the entertainment world, and I'm not going to even limit it to comedians. I had a booker on a show say to me, "You got Paul McCartney? How did that happen?" Cuz you're a jaded bunch of assholes, petty.
First of all, I'm saying it because I'm completely and totally jealous.
Okay, well, I'll play back the soundbite of your voice, and the tone of your voice does not sound anything supportive at all. It's more like, "You got him? Who are you that you would get him?" That's not what you say to somebody.
No. That's my point, is that I couldn't get him on my show. I don't even have a show and I couldn't get him. And you got him on your show. It's a compliment to you, Paul. It's a compliment that I feel bad about myself that you got Paul McCartney on your show. What else do you want from me?
But you can't be complimented.
Can you take the victory?
You cannot compliment somebody else and have it turn around back on you. You're also a voiceover artist. You have done amazing work in Ice Age 2 with Ray Romano. You played an icicle. What did you play?
An icicle? Yeah, that's what I did. I played an icicle.
What was your voice?
I was a snowflake.
I don't remember you. I saw it and I don't remember you. It was not memorable. What were you? Who were you?
Look who's jealous and putting down another person's work. I love it. Talk about turning the tables. Now the table has turned. Suddenly I did something that you hadn't accomplished.
I had Stephen Colbert on my podcast, Sugar Ray Leonard, Paul McCartney.
Right. Okay, well, there you go. So Why are you throwing that in my face? You're trying to make me feel bad about myself? First of all, Sugar Ray Leonard was not in Ice Age 2, which is something I have on him.
Right. And Paul McCartney... Black people don't like the cold, only because black people don't like the cold.
Yeah, okay. I'll leave it to you to bring race into it. But your question was...
Come on, don't be a pussy. Respond to that, you pussy. All right, go ahead. I'm listening.
What's the question? About the black people not liking cold?
Who were you in Ice Age 2? What did you play?
Oh, I think I was...
What do you mean you think?
I was a Glyptodon. That's right. I was a Glyptodon. I did what happens is they have all the big stars that do their big parts, like Dennis Leary and everything, and Ray. And then they have voiceover guys who come in and do like lots of the other like smaller dinosaurs that interact. And so I did like 7 different voices and characters for different things, usually little things where they have 2 lines here, 1 line there, and then they end up editing it. And then I think what was in, I did background looping, and one of my characters or 2 of them ended up in the final product, if that's what you want to know.
Yeah, everything you say, you just sound angry. I'm just angry in your tone.
That's only because it's 12:30 at night, and you and I do this. We're like, it's like Virginia.
That was the other thing.
You ever see Virginia Woolf? They love each other, Paul.
I call you. We're doing this. We live in New York City, but I'm out of the city right now. So I say, okay, we're going to do this at 12:30 at night. We're both comedians. We're up late. And then I call you at 12:12 or 12:10, and I go, I'm actually ready early. And you had this tone in your voice like, I thought we're doing it at 12:30. I have to do it at 12:30. It's like, what are you doing? And you can't do it at 12:10, and why would you make me seem unreasonable that I wanted to do it 20 minutes earlier at 12:10 in the morning? And you go, oh, I'm on the phone
because
with my
girlfriend. Because we schedule it.
You don't have a girlfriend.
Okay, wait a minute. Would you tell Paul McCartney, hey, Paul, hey, Paul, listen, I'm not doing anything right now. Why don't you let's do it now. You know what I mean? I think McCartney would have something else to do.
When did I become a New York cab driver who lives in Queens? What was that?
That's the only character. That's one of my go-to characters that I do. It's a guy from Brooklyn calling Paul McCartney, and that's what I envision you sounding like when you call a Beatle.
And
on the phone.
I met him at the Colbert Report. We developed a rapport because I know how I'm a people person, unlike yourself. We started talking, and I asked him to do the podcast, and he said yes. Because
that's fantastic.
He could sense that I'm did you ever listen to the interview with him? No, because a good friend would, but you didn't, and you should, because it's a good interview, and I don't often compliment myself, but I'm very proud of it. And if you were a good friend,
I actually did listen to it.
Well, then
it,
why wouldn't you call me up and say, "Hey, I heard that was awesome. It was amazing." Like, why wouldn't you do that?
No, that's my own insecurity, Paul, coming out. I don't blame you for that.
We're going to get into that in a minute. You were also in Robots with Robin Williams and Halle Berry.
Yes. I was Trash Can Bot. I love to tell people I was in a movie with Halle Berry. I was in a movie with Halle Berry. I didn't see Halle Berry on the set, and I wasn't even on a set, but I was in a movie with Halle Berry, yes.
And what does Trash Can Bot do?
Because you'd be more derisively dismissive in your tone about that.
I just was thinking about my Paul McCartney interview as I was asking you about that. That's why.
I know. You were basking in your own Paul McCartney wonderfulness.
I was.
I forget what the question was. But, no, what happened, once again, it was one of those things where I did a bunch of – it's the same production company. And I did a bunch of voices. And that's the one good thing about doing porn. You never get cut out because your part doesn't, you know what I mean, like doesn't advance the plot or anything. when you do a porn film, it usually it ends up they don't look at the thing and go, nah, I don't think it's really fleshing out the backstory of the lead character or something, so they don't cut you out. Yeah, so there you go. So like in when you do voiceovers and cartoon voices and things like that, sometimes you get cut out, sometimes you do a bunch of voices, sometimes 3 voices get in. I still get checks, so things are working out. I haven't interviewed Paul McCartney, though.
You're also the number one sheep in the award-winning Serta Mattresses commercials. And explain to us how – that's a big thing to get that kind of regular work. So you're really good in voiceover. You're a really really great stand-up and a terrific writer. Yep. You're a horrible human being on a lot of levels, but
you can't be everything, Paul.
Well, you're not. Trust me.
No one can be everything. We can't all have the amazing demeanor and easygoing charm that you have, as well as your amazing skill set and your sensual dynamism that you that comes across on stage, as well as in your interviewing. Right?
So the number one sheep. Now, when you're playing a sheep, how do you get into the head of a sheep? What are you thinking about?
Boy.
Are you thinking about like wool? Are you thinking? Like, are you like eating your own feces to prepare for that role? How do you become?
How did you guess, Paul? Did you go to like method acting school? Yes, this is what we do. I eat my own feces. First of all, I don't even know where you pulled that out. Because do sheep do that?
I would think if I were something... sheep, I would. You know what? You could people look at you and go, "That's gross." And I would just go, "I'm a sheep." Why is that gross to you? In fact, that actually could be a good joke. I'm going to write that down as a premise. Hold on.
Yeah, write that down.
I am.
Yeah, write that down.
I am writing it down. Sheep eat shit.
Feces. Its own feces.
Who's going to question it? He's a sheep. All right, let's work on this. So, yes. We also write Every Once in a Great While together, which is always fun.
Yes.
Who's going to question?
There are many great jokes in your act. I'm almost, I believe,
that whole
13 to 14% of them are written by me.
That whole bit, What Women Want, is about me, is written by me, and a lot of people don't know that. Explain this to me. So, you're really good at voiceover. Why are you so good? What makes a good voice artist?
I grew up perfectly honest response. My father was a voiceover actor.
Right, he was in
Robert
vaudeville.
McFadden.
Your father was in vaudeville. Your mother was in ballet, right?
Yes.
And you actually...
No, my mother was a water ballerina, and my mother was one of the first synchronized swimmers. She's in the Swimming Hall of Fame. She was a performer, and my father was a stand-up comedian. For many years, and then he became a voiceover actor as well, and that's where I picked up. My father was on the Thundercats cartoon series. He was Frankenberry, the voice of Frankenberry.
Count
he was
Chocolate.
Tons and tons.
Count Chocolate.
Yeah, well,
Chocula, right?
Well, no, Frankenberry, not Count Chocolate.
No, I thought it was Count Chocula.
Yeah. No,
oh,
he's Frankenberry.
See, that's too bad, because I like Count Chocolate better. I thought he was a better performer, but anyway. Your dad could get
And, thank you. And then, put someone's father down. This is a new technique as well. There you go.
And you said, this is your quote, comedy was the way our family communicated. I actually did research on you, even though you're a good friend. I did. What do you mean by comedy was the way our family communicated?
Because my father was a comic. And he was on all the time. My father would do voices all the time. Even when he was interacting with you, he would do voices.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're little, you want your dad to love you. So you basically, do whatever the family dynamic is. Mm-hmm. And so in our family, comedy was very, very important. It was like, Billy Crystal talks about like when he went to baseball games with his dad. Mm-hmm. Well, that was like comedy for me and my dad. Like that was the arena through which we communicated. And that was the way we talked to one another, through one-liners and jokes.
Would you watch a comedy together and talk about it?
And constantly.
What did he teach you? What did you learn from that?
My dad had the greatest laugh of any human being on the planet.
Can
he was loud.
Let me hear it.
It was literally like an elephant, like just said, it went through the house, and we loved making my father laugh, and we loved watching the Marx Brothers and Abbott and Costello and Phil Silvers and Bill Coe with my dad, and just anything my father thought was funny, especially the Marx Brothers. Occasionally, he hated Jerry Lewis, but whatever.
Why did he hate Jerry Lewis?
I have no idea. He thought he was making fun of retarded people or something, I think, right? Or something. He didn't understand. He didn't get
what's
Jerry,
wrong with
right?
that? What's anyway, no. And
I don't know. I don't know. That's half your act. But anyway.
All right, so now that was highly aggressive and unnecessary. So
right.
So you're anyway, having this relationship with your dad, and from your young age, 5-6 years old,
that was my first language. Comedy was actually like, how people like that was my first language. Comedy was my first language. It was like the first way that I interacted with my father was like, hey, what about that? Groucho Marx-esque one-liners, and my father would do Walter Brennan impersonations, and he would do Paul Lynde. Hey Brian, what are you eating there? You eating a muffin? chicken? Oh, wonderful. That's fantastic. What are you putting on it? Jelly? You know, like, that was that would be my dad all the time.
And how was your mom with all of this? Would she just, like, roll her eyes and go, oh, that's your father kind of thing?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. That's your dad. You know, that's who that's how he is, you know. And so there was this kind of like wanting to have like a serious relationship with him and a more close relationship with him, but also knowing that my father was like insecure and wasn't able to be completely like himself and didn't feel totally comfortable being self. So he sort of would interact with you like in shtick and voices. Sometimes he would mellow out, you know, and he would talk to you, but a lot of times it was just my father's like own insecure thing that he would do. And so it had a good side and a bad side, because on the one hand it like did, you know, it was kind of made our relationship not as seriously close as I would have wanted, but on the other hand it taught me a tremendous amount about comedy, and it was a very mirthful, joyous thing in many other ways.
But I remember you went through a period where, as an adult, like a number of years ago, where you were really struggling with issues regarding your father and seeing a therapist, like we all do as comedians and whatever. And what were you?
I was seeing your therapist. I believe,
exactly.
Right?
You were banging her.
I was talking to her about you. I think it was like Paul.
You would bang.
He interviewed Paul McCartney. How is that possible?
How is that right? I'm just an icicle.
She asked me that question. She was like, "How did he get McCartney?" I don't. She didn't even know.
You anyway. Really need to learn how to compliment people more. So what was
I know you're totally right. You're absolutely totally right about that.
That's why people don't care for you. I'm sorry that just slipped out. What was going on with you with your dad and those issues? I mean, he's passed away a number of years ago, right?
Yeah.
So what were you grappling with? We talked about it a little bit at the time, but I know you're going through some heavy stuff. And what was that?
Yeah,
all about?
No, I mean, because my dad was one. I always had this kind of like thing about outdoing my father.
Well, I thought you were looking up to your dad as a kid and wanted to be him, no?
Yes, but I also felt my father was, like most performers that are insecure, when I was a kid, I started doing voiceovers. I started doing what he did. Mm. And
how old were you when you first did your voiceover, first like professional voiceover?
Well, that was for, I was on the Big Blue Marble TV show, for a kid's show.
Cool.
And I think I did an Australian accent for that or something, like a kid from Australia or something. I don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember. But something like that. And it was like a kid from Australia. And
you know what? That's the shittiest Australian accent I've ever heard in my life. You got hired with that?
Did you tell McCartney that his British accent was fucking lousy too?
You sound like a drunk from Wisconsin. You don't sound like Australian at all. Anyway.
All right, let me hear yours. Everyone's a critic. I love this.
Hey, mate.
Right? What? That's horrible. What the hell was that?
You want some shrimp with Barbara? All right, let's go. Shrimp with Barbara?
Wow.
Is there shrimp on a Barbie? So go ahead. Well,
shrimp at a Barbie.
Now you sound like Paul Lynn.
You gotta give
cold.
Me a you gotta give me a script or something.
You sound like Paul Lynn with a cold. How do you make money at this? All right, so tell me.
Oh boy. Wow. I'm so glad I did this. Agreed to this podcast.
Yeah, like it was a detente negotiation. By the way, that was another thing. You go, hey, I want to do the podcast. I'm like, okay. So I text you. Like about a month and a half ago, we're going to do the podcast. No response. No response to the text.
No. There was a response. It was just not. It was a month and a half later, but there was a response. I mean, please, let's not exaggerate. It just didn't come with the convenience that you would have liked. But here we are now, and stop living in the past, Paul.
All right, so speaking of that, so you were competing with your dad as you started to become an adolescent and try to outdo him as a voiceover artist.
Yes, a lot of people have a kind of a thing with their dads, and outdoing my father was like a big thing for me because I sort of matched my father's career in so many ways, and it took me years to figure that out. Like, I had this idea, I think in my own head, of what I was permitted to, how successful I could be. And I sort of like almost in many ways had the exact same career as my father.
Back up. When you say permission or permitted to, what do you mean by that? Permission from your father's in a subconscious way, or who?
Yeah, in an unconscious way. I felt like when I was a kid and I was performing, my father was one of those guys who he was sort of complimentary, but it always felt like there was like this kind of edge of competitiveness with him.
So why were you competing with him? Why not just go find something else to do?
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So you want me to hang up now and seek out another career? I mean,
at the time, you can't let your old man just have what he has. You can't go like be an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor. What do you need to be in his shit for? Maybe you.
That's brilliant, Paul. That's really good. Tell that to Ken Griffey Jr. or Michael Douglas. Say, hey, Michael, stop getting in your on Kirk Douglas's shit. All right. Hey, Ken. Your father's Ken Griffey Sr. Why can't you let it go? Can't you make sell shoes or something?
I would be annoyed.
Yeah, that's great.
I would be annoyed if you or my son just...
I know that.
Okay, then add to that.
That's my point.
Add to that that you decide to start competing with me in my endeavor. Your father went through...
Exactly, Paul. This is why you're going to have serious problems with your kid. you're gonna ruin him because he's gonna feel that same edge and he's gonna cry just like I did when I felt my own feelings that I wasn't able to outdo my dad. See, there you go.
So your dad would always. So it becomes a vicious cycle because every son or daughter wants approval from their dad and their mom.
Yes,
and yes. You start to go into the same arena as your dad, and he's holding
yes.
back probably some of that approval, right? Because he's feeling
yes.
like you're competing with him. So you're creating
yes.
your own sort of weird dynamic. And
yes.
how did that affect you later as an adult when you were performing, your dad passed away? You had some issues with that later. How did that play out?
I always felt that I felt that there was a ceiling on which I always felt like I there was something holding me back in my career that didn't allow me, because I always felt I was funny as some of the guys that, you know, were very successful and stuff like that. But I always felt this kind of cap on what I was like, oh, you know, I always felt like there was a sort of like a wall that I couldn't get through. And a lot of that had to do with, you know, what my dad had struggled with in his life. He had worked very hard. You know, and I felt like my father wanted to be more than what he did. He wanted to be like maybe a successful actor, comedian, and he didn't do that. And then when I would do stuff that was sort of like more beyond what he had accomplished, I felt my father was very proud of me, but I always felt like, and it was my issue. It was like feeling like, oh, maybe he's not totally happy for me. Maybe it's like making him feel bad or something. And that's he may not have even felt that on a conscious level, but I might have picked it up and so I felt like there was a competitive thing that I had with my father. I just wanted my father to celebrate everything I did and be totally happy for me. Mm. And there were times when my father seemed like him being in that role was not something that brought him nearly the joy that his own career brought to him, you know?
And was there something that you felt held your father back from that next level of success? Because he sounds like he was very successful, but, you know, obviously we always want more and there can be more. Was there something that you observed that you thought held him back?
I used to think that, but I think I look at my father's career now and I think, wow, my father had an amazingly cool life and an amazingly cool career. Like, my father was on the Thundercats cartoon series. He had numerous cartoon shows that he did. You know, and he was Cool McCool secret agent. He was Fearless Fly. He was Milton the Monster. He had all these cartoons that were on in the 70s. And so he had this like really cool career, and I think that he did awesome. But everyone wants, you know, everyone thinks, oh, maybe I should have, you know, gone into, you know, straight acting or like, you know,
right.
Right.
And I think with your therapy that you went through, you found the answers to what's been holding you back, which I could have told you, which is your lack of talent.
Yes. That's what my therapist said, the exact same thing. She said, luckily, I was slightly more talented than you. That was the only thing she said. And then she threw me out of her office.
After you had sex with her.
She had a date with Paul McCartney. Right?
You're the king of the callbacks. I love it. How did you come? Because you're much better.
Do you get this combative with all of your guests, or how does that work?
Well, I first of all, you set me off on a wrong foot with the whole, it's 12:10, I need 20 more minutes to talk to my girlfriend.
You brought that up. You didn't have to do that.
I just drove 3.5 hours in the pouring rain to get where I am, to get this to happen, to work, and to make this a big moment for you that's going to blow your career up in a huge way. Look at the company that you're keeping. Jay Leno, Bob Costas, the host of the MythBusters. It's Thomas Friedman, the New York Times, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Do you understand the company that you're keeping by being on my show now? You're not, this isn't like some dog and pony Letterman. What did that show? The David Wetterman?
David Letterman? Yeah,
oh, that got canceled, right?
The company, those people aren't on the show with me right now. How does that help me?
So when did the breakthrough come for you where you're like, I'm at peace with this with my dad? Because you just kind of settled it in your mind and like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, my father, you know, yeah, I did come to peace with that. I really did.
How did you do that?
How?
Yeah.
Well, basically, my father got sick. My father had Lou Gehrig's disease. Mm-hmm. And so there was like a time when I went down, you know, I spent more time with him down in Florida. And my father mellowed a lot when he got older. Mm. And there was just he was able to be more serious, and we were able to talk and bond more. And I realized a lot of that was my own stuff because my father was like kind of like a kid when he was raising me. Mm. And so like I had my own like issues and own anger about his inability to be the father that I always wanted. Mm. But then I realized that, you know, instead of like wishing for the childhood you never had, you should be the adult you wish your parents had always been. Write that down. Put that on a refrigerator.
Wow. Where did you steal that from? Did you actually come up with that on your own, or did that come
I wrote that myself. That was my own thing.
Did that come out of a fortune cookie? Get the fuck out of here.
No, wow. I'm giving you pearls, and you're just throwing them into the koi pond.
But wait a minute. Let's back up a minute. First of all, you're so far up your own ass with this shit sometimes. You know, you just need to fucking go out and, like, lay some tar, like, with the regular people, or go fix some plumbing shit problems, or, like, put linoleum down and see how the real world works with all your fucking hoity-toity problems. But secondly...
Wow.
First of all,
I don't even know what any of that meant.
Lou Gehrig's disease is a terrible thing, but I'd like to have a disease named after me. There should be a disease named after you, because your personality is corrosive. There should be some kind of a disease named the Brian Scott McFadden. Why do you have three names, by the way? When did that pop up? You were Brian McFadden forever, and then you popped that Scott in there. What was that all about?
Yeah, because there's an Irish boy band singer in a band
union?
Called Westlife.
Yeah, I had that with Paul Mercurio from Australia, and I was Paul Michael Mercurio for a while, and then I had to drop the first R. Then I went to two names and dropped the first R in my name. See, we have a lot in common.
I know.
All right, so
we both suffered.
Dad,
both suffered in this industry, Paul.
You see your dad, and you resolve, but can you? Because I get the sense sometimes that you use comedy as a way to kind of not be close to people. Am I right about that? And I'm not joking.
Yes.
I mean that seriously. I'm not joking.
Absolutely.
You're kind of on at times. You're more on than some people. Some people are on a lot. You're not a lot, but you're on.
Well, here's the thing. I connect with people. This is the thing about me that's weird. Is I connect with people either very superficially or unbelievably deeply. I will talk to people about the deepest, darkest, most painful shit. Like, I'm one of those people that, like, I have no problems, like, being with people in the most painful areas of life. I just don't go there, like, right away. But, like, that's always been me. It's like I've been through a lot of painful stuff in my life. And so I always respect people who go on their own spiritual psychological journey like I did. Like I became like I was like the Consumer Reports of therapy. I went to every workshop.
I remember you stopped doing stand-up. You're a great stand-up, and we're in our, you know, one of the top comics in New York. And I and I remember you just kind of faded away, and then you were pursuing, you did Shakespeare and, you know, making film and like sort of branched out artistically. So what was the tough stuff other than your dad's issue that you were going through? You had some issues with your mom too. I remember some, what were some of the things that you were grappling with beyond the issues with your dad?
Well, my dad was, my mom was a stage mother. Okay. So she had children basically specifically desirous of getting us into show business.
Really?
Okay. So yes.
So how would that manifest itself? Like, so she'd be like, I don't want to go to this audition as a kid, you're saying, and she's like, you're going to go, and you're going to, like, that kind
no,
of
this, thing? Well, this, see, this is the complexity of my childhood. My father was this, you know, kind of egotistical performer. My mother was like the shadow, the person in the shadows behind him. But my mother wanted her own thing, but my father was like Ralph Crandon, like, you know, you're my wife, and I don't, you know, I'll make the money, and I'll be successful. But my mom had this desire to do something as well, but she held herself back. So then when she had children, she thought, oh, I'll get them into show business and I'll live vicariously through them. Okay, this is a recipe for disaster, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what happens is she gets all of us into doing commercials when we were little. We get an agent, we start doing commercials. And
how old are
my
you
father
this,
was
how old were you when you started doing commercials?
Seven.
Wow. And how old?
Okay.
And you've got brother and sister doing it too? Tell me, what do you got?
Older brother, younger sister. And we all started doing it. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
And so we all start doing commercials, and right away we start booking commercials because we were, I mean, my father would read scripts with me when I was a little kid. So I was like far advanced. I was better than the other kids.
Yeah.
Because I had the best voiceover actor on the planet living with me 24/7.
What did he teach you at that age that made you a good actor? Because you were doing voiceover commercial work or just on-camera commercial work at that age?
Both.
And what did he teach you at that age?
My father was very, very funny, a natural performer, and so I was taking acting class when I was a little kid and improv class when I was a little kid, mm-hmm. and we loved performing and we loved doing shtick with our dad and doing little puppet shows and stuff like that where we would do voices. So it wasn't like he, you know, taught me, you know, Meisner technique or the method acting or anything like that, but just being around someone who was a natural performer. And also I had his ear for voices. And my father was a master of voices, and he could listen to people, and he could impersonate tons of accents and stuff like that. And I picked up that ear as well. And so I was able to do lots of accents, lots of characters, lots of voices. And so that was passed on to me. So that gave me a leg up in the industry when I was a little kid.
So you're living this existence as a sort of a child actor being...
Yes.
And were you feeling at the time like, I don't really want to do this, but I'm going to do it because my mom and dad want me to? Or were you really like, I'm into this. This is great.
No, I didn't even think about it. It was fun. To me, it was just fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and for me, it was just enjoyable. There wasn't, the only thing that was a problem was my mom was like a nervous wreck in terms of like wanting us to succeed, right? Like it was important to her, you know, in a way that wasn't healthy, because it was like, and especially when I was a performer at school, when I was in school plays or anything like that, my mom was brutally critical and always over the top involved in a way that wasn't optimal or healthy, because she would always have lists of things I did wrong or things that it was a nightmare.
Did that make you a nervous kid as a kid? Anxious
whatever? It turned me into a freaking basket case, Paul.
Well, that we
know. No, I was a pillar of confidence. No, it was a nightmare. It was actually a very, very difficult and very harmful and damaging thing.
Did that affect your ability to get women at a young age, like in high school and stuff?
No, I always was good at that.
Now, what was that all about, really? What, because you did some voices? Did you do like Cary Grant?
The whole, you know, women like funny guys, so that was, yeah.
Listen to how your voice changes. You're like, you're almost blushing on this interview. I can feel it.
I know.
Is your penis funny? Do you have a funny penis?
Oh boy, I don't know. Where's the list of questions you asked Paul McCartney? I want you to ask me the same questions you asked him. Right?
My wife is laughing in the other room because she heard me say that to you. So if she's laughing, then
I've never heard questions like this. Is your penis funny? Right?
Well, I would think everything about you is funny, and you're always on. I would think maybe your penis is shaped a certain way that it gets a laugh when a woman sees it.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is, Paul. I don't even know how. Yes, that's what it is. It's like a puppet. It's a jack in the box. What do you want from me?
So
is there a question coming?
So you're going through this, yeah. And then when do you hit a wall as a teenager? Go,
well, here's
sucks.
The thing. So when I was a kid, I would do. We were doing commercials, and we started booking commercials left and right. We were really, really doing well, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, when I was about 10 or something, like 9 or 10, all of a sudden, no more commercials, no more nothing. And I remember going, and we weren't going to auditions anymore, and it was gone. Like, I don't know, it was like 2 years and then out. And it was like weird, and I was like, "Why? Hey, mom, why are we not doing commercials?" And I think my mother told me something like, the agency doesn't want to use you anymore, right?" Mm. And I was like, "What? Like, okay, like," and it just seemed weird. And years later, I found out, and I always suspected that my father pulled the plug on that and didn't want us doing commercials, right? Because he found that to be like. It bothered him that we were doing what he was doing, and he felt it reflected poorly on him supporting his family, that his children were making money in the business or something. Something like that, you know?
That's so bizarre, though. I'd be so excited. And
exactly.
Oh,
well, that was what
I'm
talking about. That's where that came from. So that's where I got the whole thing about competing with my dad.
I wouldn't let you go to school. I'd just make you work and support me, and I'd stay home and bang hookers all day if I were your dad. That's what I would do.
And your wife is listening to this part of the conversation right now?
Oh, she's turned on by that. In fact, I have a hooker in the other room. They stay in separate rooms.
And where is your child during this interview that's going to be influenced by this?
He's out getting crack for the party later. It's
yeah,
a whole
awesome.
Thing. There's a lot of stuff
and,
going on.
And which one of us is on all the time?
So you're keeping all this stuff inside of you, and then you kind of just had to. So why did you have to get away from comedy there? You took a hiatus for a few years, right? Like, you kind of just stopped doing it? Why? Because
2 years.
And you needed to sort out this stuff, or what?
Well, there were certain things I had not done that I wanted to do. I love Shakespeare, and I'm a classically trained actor. I had never done it, so I wanted to do something like that. So
I could never watch you in Shakespeare. I would laugh my ass off. I can't see you doing that convincingly at all.
I know. I love that. That's the main reason I did it, simply because you couldn't see me doing it.
You would just suck a bag of dicks at it. I can't even imagine that you would be a good Shakespearean actor.
This is one of the weirdest interview approaches I've ever seen.
I think you would
just suck at it.
You have a cartoon voice, so I can't see you going, "Oh, yeah. Now where are you now, Hamlet?" Like, I can't, like, it doesn't fly for me.
I know, I love that.
I wouldn't cast you at all. I'd be like, you'd walk out on stage and you'd start like three words, "Oh, Hamlet, next. Thank you."
Yeah, is there a reason why I'm on the show right now? I can't see you doing any of that. What?
So what was it about?
I think you would absolutely suck at that. I think that you'd be the worst performer in the history of mankind. This is my interview technique.
Now listen.
I am Jay Leno, and I abuse people and reduce them to tears and cut down their confidence and belittle them, and that's how I roll.
So tell me something. Was it about because I get that, I feel that too sometimes, like I like acting because it's like exercising a different muscle,
it
makes you in a way when you take a break from the stand-up, you come back refreshed because you're not sort of just doing the same thing.
I always loved dramatic serious acting. And I did Hamlet. I played Hamlet New York Public Library. I studied iambic pentameter. I played Venedig and Much Ado About Nothing, and Andrew Agoucheek in Twelfth Night, and
why is that such a difficult? Why is Shakespeare difficult to do as an actor? Is it because of the iambic pentameter? Is it because of the structure?
No, we're not used to it, and we're not trained for it here in America. That's why British actors are destroying us in every role that you see on television. British actors are so much better trained than us in every aspect of speech and movement and body work and breathing and everything else. And so it requires, Shakespeare is not, American actors are trained strictly for emotional response and basically authentic, expressing authentic emotions. But there's so much more to acting than that. And we don't have any training here in America anymore. There's no like regimental training for actors, and that's why
that.
The Brits are taking all of our jobs, because they have
a
very, very rich theatrical history in of training in many areas, character especially. That's why no American actors can do British accents, but all the Brits can do any accent that we have here, because they're trained for that. That's taken into account. That's what they do. And that's why they play all. I mean, Jesus Christ! Anthony Hopkins plays, you know, is Nixon, and Daniel Day-Lewis is Lincoln. You know what I mean? Like, it's like insane. Like, all of them are doing all of our characters, and America should be embarrassed that we can't even do our own homegrown people who are historical figures are being played by Aussies and people from New Zealand and England and Scotland. It's insane.
This is the longest speech about Shakespeare. If I knew you were going to answer this long-winded answer, I would not have asked that question. But go ahead, keep going. Now, let me ask you something.
So your question was, why is it so difficult? Because it's a totally different approach to speaking. The language is very heightened,
right.
And it's not easy. So what you'll see most American actors do is they'll affect a British accent whenever they do Shakespeare. And it's hilarious because you don't have to do that. But it's so if you watch any of the Kenneth Branagh movies, any American actors, they try to do a British accent.
Well,
Denzel Washington
you mentioned Nixon and what's his face?
Who Lincoln.
No. Who
Lincoln.
Played him? Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins.
And what he didn't do is, I always thought in comedy the best Bush impression was done by Will Ferrell, and Nixon, it's in the same sphere for me in this sense. They captured the essence of the person, but didn't get bogged down with trying to get them to themselves to sound exactly like the person. But
And
I think that's always a better way to go as an actor, is to really get the in essence of the person, and that's a deeper way to play it than, you know, doing
you're talking about a comedic approach, which is what Will Ferrell.
No, but that's Will Ferrell, but
I think
on a dramatic side that in playing Richard Nixon, Anthony Hopkins did the same thing. He captured the essence of Nixon. You could find plenty of guys, including yourself probably, that could just straight on do a better Nixon impersonation.
Oh, no, but an impersonation is not a character, an embodiment of a character.
Right,
it's not an
impersonation.
You know what I mean? Jamie Foxx didn't just do Ray Charles's voice. He embodied that guy.
Right.
You know, that's totally different than doing an impersonation of someone. That's not acting. That's just parroting a vocal tick or something like that. And that's a completely different
thing. So what did you get out of doing Shakespeare that when you came back to stand-up, did it help your stand-up in any way? Did it sort of add
What Shakespeare did, well, I loved it so much, and I was able to, it's one of those things that when you do, one of the other things about acting, and you know this because you've done it, that you don't have to get a laugh every 3 seconds when you're doing a play.
Yeah.
Or we, as comedians, the people don't even understand how breathtakingly taxing it is to constantly have to have a punchline coming every 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And that's just the nature of what stand-up is. When I was doing Shakespeare, it was awesome because I didn't have to, I was just in a character, and I didn't have to worry about like, oh, if I get laps or something like that, I can get laps here. And you just shut off that muscle and that pressure that's on you. And also, there's not much you can do. The lines themselves take care of that work. And you surrender to them, and you don't have to, like, worry about the audience rejecting you. It's Shakespeare. It's right. Some of the most beautiful writing ever. So
Why did you take that break from stand-up? It seemed to me like it was less about wanting to move towards something else, but more like you just needed to get away from it. Like, why was there?
Yeah, I'd been obsessed with stand-up for a long period of time and would work all the time, and I was just burned out. That's all. I was just burned out. I couldn't find the joy in it. I was at a place where I was just. I think my father was ill at that time as well, and I think that was a contributing factor, but I reached that place where I would get up and I was saying the same jokes, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. And I had a tough time finding my own voice on stage in terms of, like, I went through different, like, I'm sort of at a place now which is, like, really cool, where I'm like, oh, I feel like for the first time I know what I want to say, I know who I am on stage, and that's not, and sometimes that never happens, and so it during that period especially, I was at a place where I was just burnt. I was just like, it wasn't fun anymore.
What do you think you want to say? What do you think you're saying now? Or what do you think your persona is or your voice is?
I'm enjoying it again. I mean, I'm enjoying it in a way that I don't.
That's good,
think,
because the audience is not. You see what I did there? You see how I turned that tables on you? I hope you took a little lesson there in comedy. But go ahead, continue.
Yeah, go ahead.
But in terms of, because I feel like your voice now is the same voice you had before you took the break. And I don't mean that as a slight.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you kind of, you really squeeze everything out of a premise. You're a really great writer. Use your voice and your voice acting ability to really do things with jokes that not a lot of people can do. I can't do.
Well, thank you.
And you crush with it. You crush whenever you work.
Well, thank you.
So just enjoy this, because this is about the only compliment you're going to get in this interview. So
I know, I'm soaking this up. Notice how quiet I'm getting.
And so
I'll let you drone on about
this. Do you think
that
your voice changed, or do you think you just came back rejuvenated and fresh again? Because I feel like your voice is pretty similar to what it was.
Well, I think I came back more rejuvenated and in a better place. I think I needed to do that.
Yeah.
I missed acting. And when you do Shakespeare, it's like really immersive, and we were doing lots of plays, lots of rehearsals. I was a founding member of the Actors Shakespeare Company in Hoboken, New Jersey. Now they're located now in Jersey City, and for 2 years we were just doing shows, and we do Comedy of Errors, Two Gentlemen of Verona, Twelfth Night, The Tempest, you know, Much Ado About Nothing, like, and we won one right after another, and we did it with no rehearsal. That's a long story, but that's we did no rehearsal Shakespeare for the first two for the first year of did not rehearse. Yeah,
I would
crazy.
Think. See, the thing that's amazing to me is that in the morning you go and do the Sir of Sheep voice, and then an hour later you're doing Shakespeare. It's sort of like...
I know. That's one of the weirdest things, honestly, Paul, is like I've had a very strange career. Like I would be doing cartoon voices in the morning, and then I'd be doing the Sir of Sheep going, that Sir of mattress makes me so mad I'd like to rip that mattress apart. And then I'd be Benedict and Much Ado About Nothing an hour later, you know, like a couple hours later in rehearsal. And I'd be learning long, drawn-out Shakespearean speeches. And when I did Hamlet,
Now, your speech pattern, which some would call annoying, do you have to change that? Because you speak very quickly, and almost
some would call annoying. Right?
I thought you'd pick up on that sooner.
I love these barbs; they're awesome, Paul.
I wouldn't call them annoying, but others, meaning everybody that we know mutually, find you and it and you annoying. But
find me appallingly to listen to. I understand. Yes.
But do you have to because you have a fast way of talking, fast speech pattern, quick speech pattern. And, you know, you have a cadence and a sound in your voice that's a little on the cartoony side, all serious. So when you do Shakespeare, no, you do.
Right.
When you do Shakespeare, do you have to, how do you adjust for that, or do you, or do you do it the way you're doing it now? Like, you speak fast and all of that.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm also in a heightened, excited state to be on the show with you. I think that might be part of it.
Okay,
right?
That's creepy.
So my voice may be in a higher register than it normally is.
No, trust me, your voice is always
my unbelievable giddy-like enthusiasm.
See, now that
I think you attribute some of that.
I feel that was totally sarcastic and an unnecessary swipe at a host of an award-winning podcast.
I don't know anything about it. I think it's awesome what you're doing. I'm excited about it. I'm
So what is going on with women with you? Because every time I see you, it's always like a woman from a Russian gulag. It's never just
That's what it is, a Russian gulag.
It's never like Mary O'Connell from Passaic, New Jersey. It's always like Svetlana, which is literally the name. Is that still your girlfriend, or is that one of your girlfriends? It's Svetlana. Or it's
It was Svetlana. During a certain period in you and I's relationship, when you were in a troubled state and I was helping you out on a daily basis, I went on a Slavic binge where I dated a woman named Annika, another woman named Svetlana, another woman named I don't know why, but it just I tend to binge from different one girl was from Lithuania, and then I just went on a binge about that. So is there a question, or am I allowed to? Is this an immigration issue?
You don't need to ask the host if there's a question. You just need to back off and let me get to where I want to get with my question. And what I'm saying is I find that to be fascinating. So what was it about Russian women that, or these Ukrainian women or whatever, that like drew you?
Well, there was to tell you the truth, I think there was like this those women are very the women that I met for. I went. It was weird. I just waited four women who were from Moldova, Russia, Lithuania, and they were very, cold, but I made them laugh, so they thought I was adorable, and I met them at clubs, and one was a stripper, the other one was a.
How do you date a stripper? Why would you date a stripper? Doesn't that weird you out? You know she's banging guys for money at the club. You know she.
That's the weird part.
Oh, you're so fucking naive. Come on, what are you crazy?
Well, how many strippers have you dated?
They all do it for money. Come on.
No, hold on a second. You didn't answer the question, Paul. How many strippers have you dated?
I killed three. I didn't date them. I just killed them.
All right. Thank you. Then you're speaking from no knowledge whatsoever.
You think that
I never said that.
Okay.
Right. I'm talking about the ones that I met.
How do you
know
she's telling
you
the truth? It didn't weird you out that she stripped? That wasn't weird to you?
It was an experience. It never weirded me out at all. No, of course not. Why would I wouldn't have dated them.
I couldn't. Right? I couldn't do it. I admire you for doing it.
I understand, Paul. I understand. You don't have the strength of intestinal fortitude. It takes a special kind of a real man.
So who are you dating now? What kind of a woman is she?
She's a dancer. She's a ballet dancer.
Oh, they have small breasts. She probably has small breasts.
Okay, I don't know why that's relevant or germane to the point.
You don't need to, you just need to answer the question. Does she or does she not have small breasts?
What's that? That's a personal question about someone.
I told you that we were going to get personal on this. Don't back off now and be a pussy. Just be.
Well,
just
I don't know.
My wife has small breasts. There. Does that make small is like a handful or less? If you have a.
There you go.
Size
okay. Leg. Yes. Right, that, does that answer your question?
I'm
does
a
that
big
make
fan
you feel?
Of
that. I didn't know this was like that Stern show. I didn't know.
So let me ask you. So explain to people, because you write really well, and we should write together more again. I'm going to be back in the city more. You want to write together some more? We should do that. I have fun when I do that. Do you like doing it?
It depends on how you define the word fun.
See?
So occasionally. You get very curmudgeonly, though, with me. You like, if you're very sensitive to criticism.
No,
I notice that about you.
No, I'm not.
You're so sensitive, Paul. You're so sensitive.
All right, I'll do it when I won't be so sensitive, but I think you're crazy. I like the criticism because I always want to try to make stuff better, so I disagree with you.
No, I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about criticism in general.
Well, I'm talking about writing together. You want to get together and write together. We're going to do that.
Sure,
right?
Why not?
Now,
what do you got? Let's write right now. What's your joke?
I'm working on a bit where I got in a big fight with a 22-year-old black woman on the subway for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. She called me an asshole because she claims I wouldn't let a woman sit down. I claim the woman didn't really want to sit down. She didn't ask. And I said, if you're so concerned about her, you let her sit down. She goes, well, you're a man. You should have let her sit down. And I said, oh, I see. So you need to give me a scorecard because I got to fight. I don't know when I'm supposed to treat women as equals and then when I'm not and supposed to put them on a pedestal. So why don't you tell me? I said, otherwise, why don't you give her your seat? You're a young, healthy woman. She goes, no. I said, then you're a hypocrite. I said, if you think men and women should be, she'd call an asshole, hypocrite, you're calling me an asshole, I'm calling her a hypocrite for literally from 86th Street to 59th Street for 15 minutes, and the whole car is watching, just rapt attention, like they couldn't, it was unbelievable, right? Just, and then I'm about to leave, and we're arguing, and the woman who was at the center of this comes over and takes off her wooden leg and pounds it and goes, stop arguing! So that's how I'm in it. That's how I'm ending the joke right now, but I think it could I could end differently. So I need to take that somewhere funny or funnier. So go.
Yes.
What do you got?
You can say that again, Paul.
Maybe that's why I can't take criticism because of sarcastic comments like that.
No.
So go ahead. I think that there's. I want to do this joke because.
Well, you know the way we write together is usually if we're writing together, I will say, okay, what do you want to say about this joke?
And
I always come from an emotional place with anybody that I'm writing with.
I know, and I'm and the place is that I say that they're in this particular case, it's in the context of. You know, I tend to sort of feel like I'm going to change the world by sort of confronting people with their shit when they're assholes, right? So I feel like, it was inappropriate for her to speak to me that way. The first thing I said to her when she said that is, am I fucking you? She goes, what do you mean? I go, because the only person I let talk to me like that is somebody who fucks me, and that's my wife, and you're not my wife, and you're not fucking me, right? So, So what ended up happening was we went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And one thing, and so emotionally how I felt about it is how I felt about it in the moment, which is, you know, people can act like assholes and they break my heart. And then I try to correct their behavior and I make it worse for myself generally. So that's kind of where it's coming from, right? What do you got?
I got nothing.
All right, see, this is how we usually write. You ask me that question, I answer it, and then you have nothing. And then we just sit there.
Yeah, I have nothing. Well, because there's a kind of like, okay, first of all, should I ask you if this really happened?
Of course it happened. It happened exactly the way I told you it happened. All of my stories happened exactly the way I tell them.
I understand that. My point is just because something, you know, I love when comedians go, all good comedy is based on truth, which is really dumb because it's half of some good comedy comes from truth. A lot of good comedy comes from falsehood, dishonesty, and exaggeration.
All right.
So, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, I never understood that whole thing about, look, I love Richard Pryor as my fucking main guy, and I watch it a lot, and I see so much truth in that. But I see other comics that are not truthful at all and are very funny, too. You know, so, I mean, how much is based on truth? So you have this story.
But that's not the reason to not try to write a joke about it.
Of course not.
I mean,
I'm saying, right. But the point of the story, you know, you've got a story. Then, like, this is something that, okay, this happened. But to describe that to somebody, how funny is that? And what can we bring to this that something important and funny that comes from the Paul Mercurio perspective that isn't just ranting or angry or
whatever. It's not just ranting or raving. It's not ranting or raving at all. It's me talking about how I feel about people, people's behavior, how I think it's inappropriate, and how I react to that behavior, and how sometimes, and I think it's all very telling, and I don't think it's surface at all, and I don't think it's just me ranting. It's me describing a scenario that is a reflection of who I am and how I feel about people. And I think that's what stand-up
right, but this is a raw situation with a lot of emotion at play. So sometimes to turn that into something that is funny and has like a twist ending or something that, you know, is sometimes not always easy, as you know.
So why, instead of like I bring my car to the shop and say to you, hey, can you try to fix it? Instead of you trying to fix it, you give me 15 minutes and tell me why I shouldn't have this kind of car. Why don't you just fucking try to help me write a fucking punchline for it? And if we don't come up with it, then I'll conclude that this isn't something that I can get a joke on. Why don't you try?
You're right. But maybe we should do this when we're not on the podcast.
Okay, you said let's work on a joke, a-hole. All right, so here's
the
thing
I know, but that wasn't a joke. That was a story. I'm talking about, I thought it was going to be something
that I
could help the wording.
I tell a lot of stories now. I'm not telling jokes. I'm telling stories.
I understand that. I'm saying that thing is not something that I can write because it's a true story. What am I supposed to come up with a fake ending for you if you want to tell a true story?
So here's the thing. When you write for you, explain to people who are listening how you write. And people should check your stuff out. It's really, really funny. You got a great bit on What Women Want. It's killer. And your stuff's tight and you have good, great callbacks. So how do you come up with
something will bother me that I want to say. Mm. It's like, and I love stuff about comedy. I love to talk about certain aspects of what I do and certain aspects. And I want to relate. I like to relate. Like I, for some reason I'm obsessed with like professions and jobs right now talking about, I get obsessed with a certain topic. Mm. Like everyone thinks their job is hard. Comedians bitch about their job and we work like we do nothing, right?
Yeah.
like but we are always bitching and there's people that are working on a loading dock, you know, whatever. So like I'm fascinated by like a topic. Like I was always fascinated by, I dated this one of the girls I dated was like a model, right? So she said, and she used to do print modeling, so she would go and she would go Brian, you do not understand how difficult modeling is. Very hard. It's very hard what we do. Supermodels claim that their job is hard. And I always used to think that was funny because if being a supermodel is hard, what's easy? You know what I mean? Like if that's,
right.
Like and Svetlana, the chick that I dated, so she would go, why, it's very difficult what we do. And I would go, Svetlana, did you work in a coal mine or a fishing trawler or at UPS? What are you using as a comparative frame of reference? What did you do before you were whisked away to Paris when you were 15, and had bulimia, than doing print work that you are claiming to know what hard work is, you know? Because modeling, and this is like an example of what something will set me off like this. Like that bothered me, and I always wanted to do a joke about it. And then I finally worked on it for a while, and then I got the idea that, you know, like because modeling is the only job where your actual job is to do nothing. Okay, it's the only profession that what you're basically, every other job you get is, what do you do? The boss will come in and, hey, what are you doing? Get up, stand up, do something, move around, get to work. What do they say in modeling? Hold it, don't move, freeze, right there, don't move. It's the only job. It's the only job where if you were paralyzed, it would give you a competitive advantage. Okay, It's like, hey, why is Anna getting all this work? Oh, she had a spinal cord injury. Okay, so yeah, she's cleaning up now. So that is an example of like a bit that I was working on, trying to get some angle. Like why models think their job is hard, and it's not hard. But no one wants to say, oh, I got a cushy life. You know what I mean?
And are you working that bit out? Are you doing it now?
Mm-hmm.
And how's it going?
Yeah, it needs something. It needs the wording of that, the whole hold it, freeze, don't move. I got to fix that. But there's something really funny in the idea that modeling.
Why do you feel
modeling,
you need to fix that? Don't you think that section's working?
Yeah, but I have to. This is how perfectionistic and insane I am. I have to decide hold it, freeze, don't move right there, which goes second, third, fourth, and fifth. Mm. It's just like What Women Want. if you don't put it in the right order, it's not funny. And if you do put it in the, and then if you hit it in just the right cadence and rhythm, it's hilariously funny. Mm. And that's what's weird. And there's a precision to it that I like to bring to something. And I'm working on that bit, and I don't quite have the it's like to me, it's like picking a lock, and you just go, yeah. Oh, well, I got it. I got the number one. I got that number. I got that number. And then I got that number.
And
you know,
well,
it's like,
and
then they line up.
Are you working on this at home more, or do you work it out on stage for you?
Both. But at a certain point, for me, like What Women Want got worked out on stage a lot. But I had to get the wording of that at home because it was complicated, and I had to get the order right. And so there was a combination of onstage work and offstage work that went into that. A lot of, like, precise writing and a lot of precise – because, you know, I don't know why. Some guys just wing it and get it. But I need sometimes with my stuff, I have to get the right word in the right order or it's not funny, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Seinfeld has said that too. He goes, you know, I have a joke where it ends with me – looking off into the distance, and if I turn my head to the left and look, it's not as funny as if I turn my head to the right. And there
right.
are those
it's
things,
amazing.
Yeah, and there's certain things, and certain jokes work better in certain order, and, you know, certain jokes work better at the beginning of a set versus the end of the set.
I know, it's amazing. If you put the joke in the wrong place
yeah.
in your act after you've done one joke, I remember Ray Romano used to talk about how he had jokes about thinking about cheating on his wife, and if he did those jokes, he couldn't do those jokes after he talked about his kids because the audience hated him, right?
Yeah.
But you had to do those jokes early in his act before he talked about having twins, before he could do this. It was such a little tiny thing that no one thinks about as a performer. But yeah, this is the kind of stuff I like to talk about. This is the meat of comedy, you know.
And do you feel? Like, the other thing is you never feel like it's done, you know what I mean? I mean, some bits are done, but a lot of you always feel bits can be
yeah, I know.
Built.
Well, like, What Women Want is like done, but there's, like, two areas in that bit that I go, why doesn't that get a laugh? Like, it used to bother the hell out of me, you know, that there was a precision to it and that one, like I think it's funny to say, you know, like I can't remember the joke, but the bit is women want a man who's serious but playful, right? I think that is much funnier than the response it gets from the audience. I don't know why. I just think it's like women want a man who's serious but playful. Like I think that's funny. He's serious, but he has to be playful. Mm. And I'm like, why doesn't that get?
But is that the beginning? Because you've got a series of things that you say there. Is that the beginning of a series of things?
Yeah. No, that's number two. It's like women want to, you know, things that don't mix. You want a realist who's romantic, a guy who's serious but playful, who's confident but humble and horny but faithful. Mm. Right. So those are those four things. Those four. You know, kind of things, they build on each other, and by the end, that gets a huge laugh because I've hit them with so much information, and the wording and the poetry of it works. But it always bothered me that serious but playful. Mm. I think that's funny, but they never get a laugh, and I'm sitting going, am I doing something wrong?
They might just still be building to it. You know, sometimes audiences just need to. We think people should get things faster than they really should because they're in our head, and we've said it 4,000 times, and we know it's coming. But you know, they're looking.
Another thing about that is that you kind of you know. An audience needs time to rest and to process what they've heard.
Yes.
And you can't have a joke, build, joke, joke, bang, 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 bang. You have to have those pieces of filler that, you know, patter or filler that
right.
allow the audience to process
something. Well, there's a lot of things
that
go into
time.
This. You know, there's a lot of things that go into this that people don't realize. Like if there's a second show Friday, especially, I'll do my longer story kind of stuff early in the set because their attention span's going to be nil by the end because you're at the end of a long day of working and now it's 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night and you've been drinking and eating and whatever. So, like, things have to shift and move and, you know, I also find sometimes if I take individual jokes and join them together, I find themes. Sometimes the forest dictates the trees, and sometimes the tree dictates the forest. You know, like I'll mm-hmm. find a theme just by moving jokes around and putting them together that I didn't know existed when the jokes were done in separately in different spots in my act.
Right. Well, that's, yeah. No, though things like that are those little things that only comics understand and comics know. And I, like that's why I hate when, you know, you read and, you know, bloggers talking about comedy and telling us what's funny and what we should be doing and all that stuff. And I want to just commit Harry Carey. But
how do you feel about
anything?
How do you feel about rape, you know, guys talking about rape? And, you know, there was that thing a little while ago, like, you know, some, you know, women sort of, you know, guys joking about rape or this or that. Do you feel there's any place a comic can't go, or is that bad for comedy when you start to tell?
Well, comedy will take care of that. See, the thing about the rape joke controversy is kind of crazy because it's just one of those things that people just go, you shouldn't joke about rape. It's like, well, it depends on the joke, obviously, because it depends on who's being victimized, what's the perspective of the joke. It's just one of those moronic things that people started talking about, and it was like, you can't joke about that. Well, of course you can joke about that. You can joke about anything, but the darker the subject, the better a game you better bring to the craft of it. Mm-hmm. If you're just some hack guy taking on the Holocaust or something like that just for shock value, then you don't deserve respect and stuff. But if you're you can tackle any topic. I don't understand why rape is put into this sacrosanct category when I see jokes about pedophilia and all kinds of shit, and people make jokes all the time about that's what humor is for. That's mm-hmm. what it's there about. Mm-hmm. So when people talk about like rape jokes, I'm trying to think, did you have somebody on your show who talked about this, the rape joke controversy? Have you discussed it on the show at all?
No. I just think that because
you hear, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You hear what?
No, I'm just wondering, like, I've actually been interested in this, what I'm hearing, because I don't know about you, but I hear those, rape jokes. And I was like, I've been doing comedy for how long you've been doing comedy, right? How many rape jokes have you heard? Like I've been doing comedy for over two decades, and I can count on like one hand the number of the so-called rape joke epidemic that's out there. I didn't hear any of these. I've heard plenty of I've heard some, but it's like, is there some weird rape joke rooms that are taking place somewhere where people?
I think at some point some words are triggered. Trigger words for people to shut down, you know, rape or, you know, the N-word or, you know, like certain things just people shut down when they hear it and they can't get
right.
Past
but the, I, but they, I, but I didn't, but there's, the but word. There's that other thing about where they say, there might be someone who was raped who's in the audience, right? Like there's trigger warnings, you know, you've heard about this, right? Like where one of the reasons why they argue against, you shouldn't do rape jokes is because someone who was raped might be in the audience. And it's like, well, first of all, I don't know where you're getting the idea that someone, I don't know where these people get the idea that anyone who's a victim of something can't ever hear about it ever and can't possibly deal with it, and if it's mentioned they're going to run screaming from the room. Right? And I don't understand why rape is put in the only category where that's true. Like why do we have to ask, are there any soldiers here, that because we're going to talk about war now and you might have a trigger warning, and why, and anybody here, you know, why are we putting this in? Anyone lose a child? Anybody about murder? You know what I mean? Like what? Oh, cancer. Anybody ever have cancer? Because we're going to do jokes about cancer now. Right. Why don't you fill out a form before you go to the fucking comedy club? That's crazy, right?
You're
treating people like Fabergé eggs, you know?
Yeah. And then, that's part of the problem is it's become so commercial that people want it to be squeaky clean. Listen, I actually enjoyed this more than I thought I would.
Right. I wish I could say the same.
Come on, you're the best. You're the best. You know, I love you. Yeah, you're the best. Where can people see you? What do you got going on? What do you want to plug so people can waste their time and go see your art?
I'm going to find me on Twitter. Find me on Twitter. I tweet on there.
Well,
B. Scott McFadden.
Tell him what it is on Twitter. Don't just say find me.
B. Scott McFadden on Twitter. B. Scott McFadden. Follow me. This is how I'll find out how many followers your podcast has, because I'll find out how many new followers I get, and
see,
then I'll go.
You have
I'll
to
do
make
the math.
You have to make everything a competition, like your old man did. Just enjoy the moment, okay?
It's not competing with you. It's trying to profit from you. That's all it is. It's exploiting you for my own all purposes. Right, that's nothing to do with competition, Paul.
And do you have a CD you're trying to sell?
Yes, What Women Want, it's called, conveniently enough, on iTunes.
What do you charge for that?
What do I charge for it? I don't know. Like, what? $50. It's a gold-plated CD. It's, it's like, I don't know, $12, $15, whatever a CD goes for. I don't buy CDs anymore.
That's a lot of money.
What's that?
That's a lot of money, $12. I don't know.
I have my personal valet, Fritz, buy all of my music on CD, so.
All right, this has been Brian.
No, I don't do that. I don't involve myself in that.
This has been Brian Scott McFadden. We're going to have to do another one of these down the road to talk more about comedy, but I wanted people to get to know you and dislike you.
More about comedy, the mechanics of comedy, the precision, the brutality of the give and take. Yes.
All right. Well, listen, it was a pleasure having you on my show, and I hope to run into you soon in the city. And let's get together and do some writing, will you?
All right.
And don't spend the time writing with me telling me why I shouldn't be trying to write a joke about something. Just help me write the goddamn joke, okay?
All right. I understand, but like I said, Paul, if you're going to write a true story, how am I supposed to write that?
All right. This has been Brian Scott McFadden. Good luck with your Russian bride, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. You got it.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.